It's our fall gardening show. What are you harvesting in your garden right now? Broccoli, squash, potatoes, boatloads of kale? This is payoff time for many avid vegetable gardeners. And we've had a terrific stretch of weather for those fall gardening chores. Maybe you've been dividing perennials or moving some plants to a sunnier spot for next year. Perhaps you'd like to try something new this fall and plan to gather seeds from native plants for future gardens. I'm Jennifer Rooks. It's time for our annual fall gardening show, and our experts will answer your questions. They'll also talk about expanding native plant habitats, how to do it, and why. Join us with your gardening tips, questions, and conundrums. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. This time of year brings new challenges for gardeners. Today, we'll learn about how to prepare for the cold weather ahead, learn about seeds, bulbs, native plants, and more. And, of course, we will answer your gardening questions. Joining me in the studio, Heather McCargo. She is founder and executive director of the Wild Seed Project. And Peter Bacher is director of properties for Maine Audubon. As always, we want to hear from you. How does your garden look these days? Wondering what you can still plant, how to save seeds, any other questions, our phone number 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Peter, Heather, welcome to Maine Calling. First time for both of you. This is going to be really fun. And before we talk about the projects you're involved with, I just want to ask each of you about your personal gardens and what you're doing right now, Heather. Are you harvesting? Are you already preparing beds for next year? What's going on in your garden?
Well, since my specialty is native plants, most of my yard is planted with native species. And then I do have a small vegetable and herb garden. And I have been a vegetable and herb gardener my whole life, organic one. So I do a lot of that. But now that I live in Portland, it's smaller. So what's really different about the native plants versus the vegetables is vegetables are cultivated species, and most of them come from tropical or Mediterranean climates. That's why this time of year, the season is ending. It's getting cool, and it's time to harvest and maybe save some seeds or eat the food or prepare the beds for the winter so they don't erode away. So for most of my landscape, and my garden's young, you know, it's an old yard in Portland, but I've only been there 5 years, so I have a lot of young native trees and shrubs and perennial wildflowers and ferns and grass. There, I'm not doing anything except for letting them set seed and still enjoying all the butterflies and bees that will come up until the frost time. Mm-hmm. So I don't cut all of that back. But I've pulled up, you know, my tomato plants. I usually find by late September, even though they'll still produce tomatoes, they don't have the taste anymore. So I harvest them all and put them on the windowsill. So some of those vegetables are cleaned up. Mm-hmm. And I've planted actually spinach and lettuce and beets and mache and arugula for a fall harvest.
All right. Is it too late to plant those things for a fall
harvest?
No,
you can still do spinach, and it's getting a little late for the lettuce. Tatsoi, which is Asian, a lot of the Asian greens do really well over the winter, and arugula, like literally into the winter, especially if you cover them with Rimae or a cold frame. So it's not too late for all those late season greens. And Elliot Coleman's book, Four Season Farm, is a great place to go read about what you could be planting.
A great resource for that. Yeah, we were lucky enough to have Elliot on the program last year. Really fun. Peter, what about you? What are you doing in your home garden right now?
Well, I'm still harvesting tomatoes. I'm afraid that I've been long afflicted by growing tomatoes and grow far too many than is reasonable.
What a nice problem to have.
It is. I've learned how to make some good pizza sauces and things like that. I did get a little carried away a couple of years ago and built a small 10 by 12 poly house so that I could extend the season for that, and also so that I could try and grow some greens into the winter. I've had mixed success with that, but right this year was not a great year in my garden. I had a lot of slug damage to my lettuce and things.
I did too. A lot of slugs. Yeah. What did you do about them?
Not a lot. I did put some beer out. Around my garden, I have a lot of native plants growing and other things, and it's probably a little bit, it's not a great environment in some sense, is that there's too many hiding places for slugs and moist spots.
Right.
So I'm thinking next year I may use one of the organic slug control products, but I'm not sure.
Right. Yeah, so I was finding I was just pulling the lower leaves off as they got ugly. I sort of tried the beer as well and tried the sluggo and then just ended up just pulling leaves off as they looked ugly.
Yeah. So right now that's about all I have left. I prepared a couple of beds for next year. I do want to get ready in a few weeks to plant some garlic for next year.
Okay.
And I'm trying some potatoes.
Well, let me stop you here because I know a lot of people listening are beginning gardeners. When you say you prepared some beds for next year, what did you do?
I have some chickens, so I have a source of organic material, and I used that to mix into the – I have some raised beds. I don't have a lot of sun, so they're positioned as in my best spots for it. And I added that into the soil and turned it over, raked it smooth. I haven't planted yet, but I do intend to plant some winter rye just to help hold some of the nutrients. It's nice to cover it.
Okay, and this always comes up, planting a cover crop. Would you recommend a cover crop even for a small vegetable garden, or does this have to be substantial size to be worth sort of the effort?
I hadn't thought of it that way, but generally I planted in these small 4x8 raised beds. Yeah.
Okay.
Planting a cover crop is very easy, no matter what the size.
Okay, so it just means sprinkling some seed. And then the next spring, digging it under, right? Or pulling it out? What do you do with
Depending what it is.
Okay.
You know, typically, oats didn't used to be hardy in Maine, and so they would just get winter killed. Now that the climate's warmer, sometimes a few of them will come back. But on my vegetable beds, what I do after I harvest, I add a new layer of compost.
Mm-hmm. So you add the compost in the fall.
Mm-hmm. And I'll do some more, because I just planted some spinach and other greens. And with vegetables, remember, we're always taking away and eating and, you know, not returning our nutrients back to the soil. So you've got to add compost or manure.
So if you added your compost because you planted some fall crops, if you're not planning to plant fall crops and you just want to have a nice quality bed in the spring, do you still want to put down compost in the fall, or does it not matter as much?
Cover crops would be simpler and easier, and then save. It's hard to have enough compost. You know, the vegetables really benefit, most of them, from plenty of compost. So if that was the case, I would just cover crop it. And it can be annual clover this time of year, which germinates right away, or the oats, which also germinate right away. It's very satisfying because once you pull your vegetables out, it kind of looks barren.
Yes.
And so you can sow the clover or oats, and if it rains, it'll green up within a week and look beautiful.
I do have to point out, the first time I planted winter rye, I looked at it next spring and I thought, oh my goodness, what am I going to do now? I've got this big thicket of grass.
Right.
But a simple turnover and it was gone. It decomposed readily. I kind of had the image in my mind that I had all this grass that I was going to be fighting all season.
Right. So a simple turnover, you mean you just took the spade out and by hand, just turned over some soil.
Turned it over, raked it smooth, and went from there.
Yeah. Okay. Well, now I want to talk about you all's projects. And Heather, you are the founder and executive director of the Wild Seed Project. Tell me about that.
So we're a young nonprofit all about inspiring people about the beauty and importance of native plants and trying to get people to take action and plant more of them. And by, native is sort of a very political word. And what it means is the plants from your region. So really, plants pre-Columbian, because when the Europeans came here, we started causing a lot of disruption. And now about a third of the wild plants in Maine are not native. And it's, plants are the base of the food chain. And it's your region's indigenous plants that support all the other creatures up and down the food chain, from the insects to the birds to the other mammals, and then the life in the soil. So most people don't know the wild plants anymore, and there's a lot of myths and misunderstandings about them, whether they're, you know, whether you can plant them, whether they look good in your yard, are they going to be showy enough? And so I've been working with these plants my whole life, and they're beautiful, and they have really retreated in my adult lifetime. And so I'm trying to get people excited, and that's the work of Wild Seed, to plant them back in our more developed landscapes where we've pushed them out.
Sure. I know that a lot of people know that purple loosestrife and burning bush are not native and problematic. What are some other plants that people may not realize are not native that are common and, right. and popular?
Almost everything. Yeah, a lot of what you go and see at the nurseries are plants from another part of the world. And you know, until recently, we had enough wild land left that it didn't hurt that we weren't including them in our garden. So, man, you know, lots of trees and shrubs. Maple, you know, the Norway maple is a tree from Europe that is, you know, really widely planted street tree in Portland. It's actually an invasive species here. It doesn't do that back in Europe. It plays nicely in its ecosystem. And pretty much all the invasives were introduced by horticulture. Now, nobody did it trying to cause a problem. They were introduced because they were beautiful.
Right. And it was exciting.
Yeah, and it was exciting. And, you know, if you're looking for exciting, start learning about the natives because they've been neglected by horticulture. And there are a lot of great-looking ones that do really well in the garden.
Okay, so I'm listening. I say, sure, I'm going to add some natives to my garden. What's a great one to start with or two?
Shad or serviceberry, American hazelnut, some of our native viburnums, of which we have a dozen species, hawthorn. For a shade tree, all of our native trees make excellent, you know, yard trees. Mm-hmm. So oak, maple, birch, hickory.
And asters are native,
yes,
right?
Yes, asters.
What about black-eyed Susans?
Right now, black-eyed Susans are native. The one that's abundant everywhere in Maine now actually is the gene pool from the Midwest. Mm. The one that was indigenous here has become very rare, but it looks pretty much the same. It's just a subspecies. So, you know, if you look in meadows, meadows are the ecosystem that has more than 50% of the species are not native. And we've really favored exotic species in our open areas because we mow in the during the middle of the growing season, which favors exotics. But where people haven't mowed, you'll see lots of asters and goldenrod. And those are top biodiversity plants as far as supporting pollinators and songbirds. And all the other creatures, not only when they're blooming, but then when their seeds ripen, too, those are eaten by a lot of other creatures.
Yeah, and I know it's hard for a lot of gardeners to leave them when the seeds are developing, but that's really important,
yes.
isn't it, if
yes,
you want to
is.
Have. Peter, turning to you, tell me about maintaining the properties at Maine Audubon. I'm sure a lot of what Heather's saying is what you already know, working on native plants, but Maine Audubon inherits properties from places that didn't plant native plants, right? Are you pulling things out? And
Probably a little bit of everything. Maine Audubon existed before there was really a strong land trust movement, so we haven't inherited some lands, as you say. But managing a property involves a number of things, and I, as a lifetime gardener and landscape and nursery person, my pleasure is in maintaining the plant aspect. And each property is different. Our main location in Falmouth was formerly a farm where the man who owned it grew peonies, a non-native species, but he grew hundreds of varieties that he sold all over the country. So we preserve some of those as a legacy while we're trying to bring some of the regular plantings around. As Heather mentioned, it's the base of the food web. We want to support the insects because that's what the birds are going to eat. If you want to have a valuable habitat, and that's really what Maine Audubon is about, you've got to have those native plants. So as I work on the landscape, pulling some of the non-natives that I don't need, preserving some of the legacy plants, and then planting a number of natives. We're also trying to do a meadow planting, as Heather was talking about, where we just planted a bunch of plugs, basically small native plants, to try and get some more pollinators in the meadow there. we're going to see how that grows back up because we're not able to extinguish all the non-native plants that were there as well. It's kind of a experiment in progress. But other properties, I have significant invasive problems with honeysuckle and bittersweet. And we're doing battle against some of these where we feel we can have some success. And others, we're trying to kind of get our plan together for how we might be able to do that. Because it improves the entire habitat and location. So it becomes better birder locations and things like that. But some of it, it's a tall order, and it's not really well suited to picking here and there. You really need to make a concerted effort when you're ready.
Oh, sure. Based on former gardening programs on Maine Calling, I can tell you you're not the only one with troubles with honeysuckle and bittersweet. I think this is the Maine state problem. Heather, you advocate seed saving. I think that's kind of intimidating for a lot of people. Give us a little primer. How does one start seed saving, especially of native plants?
Well, it's not seed saving. It's sowing the native seeds.
Okay, so you're not getting people to gather them. You want them to buy them and plant them.
Gathering your own seeds is part of learning to propagate the plants, and I always think it's best to have people to sow the seeds first because that's the first step of watching the whole life cycle of the plant. Then you can have those plants in your yard, and then you can watch the seeds ripen and learn to gather them. So there are many species that are easy to judge when the seeds are ripened, like that milkweed and aster and goldenrod. And most of them, you know, I'm only halfway through my seed collecting season. What most people don't realize is how long it is from when a native plant might bloom to when the seeds ripen. So the last seeds I collect are well into November, which is why the mowing even now sets back the reproduction of the native plants. Now, with vegetables, I think it's great if you're growing heirloom vegetables to learn to save the seeds of them, but it's a very different process because those are cultivated plants and how you handle that seed saving than to plant in the spring, and you have to save them indoors because it's too cold outside. But our native seeds, they need a winter outdoors, most of them, for them to break through their dormancy and germinate. So
now is a good time to plant them.
Well, it's actually too early.
Too early?
Really late fall. Remember, lots of seeds haven't ripened yet.
Right.
It's only the end of September. There are still many species whose seeds are just in the process of forming and ripening. So really, Thanksgiving, Christmas, even into
really?
The new year is the best time.
So even digging through some snow?
No. So what I like to have people do is sow their seeds in pots with good organic potting soil, or you could make a nursery bed, again, with some organic potting soil. I don't like to have people sow directly into their vegetable garden or their garden because there's so many weed seeds. You know, a foot of soil will just have thousands of weed seeds just in that surface.
So give it a fighting chance.
Yeah. So you sow the seeds in pots and put them outside. So you could, let's say it was New Year's Day, you could do it in your kitchen after the holidays, after you're sick of people and eating, and then carry those pots outside, cover them with some wire so that the squirrels and chipmunks won't get at them. And the seeds, no matter what the weather, the freeze and thaw and ice storms, snowstorms, you know, our native seeds need that winter outside to break through the heavy seed coats. But again, that's not how it is for your vegetables because they're like a sheep and they need a little more protection. Most of our vegetables are warm weather except for like the tatsoi and spinach. They can handle the cold. So
Great. It's
different. That's what's most confusing to people is domestication versus wild plants.
Right. Well, we do have to take a quick break. Lots of calls coming in. We're talking about gardening and seed saving and seed sowing and native plants. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Friends School of Portland for preschool through grade 8, teaching peace in a changing world. More information at friendsschoolofportland.org. And Lamy Wellahan, a Maine family-owned shoe store since 1914, committed to keeping the entire family comfortable, healthy, warm, and dry.
While Democrats say a growing pile of evidence supports their call for impeachment, President Trump maintains he's done nothing wrong.
No push, no pressure, no nothing. It's all a hoax, folks. It's all a big hoax.
Today, the acting director of national intelligence testifies about it. The latest on Trump, Ukraine, and the push for impeachment this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
That's coming up today at 4 here on Maine Public Radio. And Maine Public Radio will broadcast an hour-long NPR special this evening at 8 on today's developments in the Ukraine inquiry, including this morning's congressional hearing with the Director of National Intelligence regarding the whistleblower complaint on President Trump's conversation with the Ukrainian president. That's tonight at 8 here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, we're talking about fall gardening and answering your questions. Joining me, Peter Bacher, Maine Audubon's Director of Properties, and Heather McCargo, Executive Director of the Wild Seed Project. We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We'll start with Steve calling from Biddeford. Hi, Steve. Go ahead.
Hi. I was wondering. I'm sorry. I was wondering if daffodils and tulips are perennial and self-propagating. And I was also wondering on compost if I'm causing weed problems by putting leaves and lawn trimmings in there.
All right. So two questions. We'll go to the second one first. Compost question: if you put leaves and lawn trimmings in your compost, is that problematic?
No.
It's great, right?
As long as you get the proper heating, that's fine.
Yeah. And on Maine Callings before, people have said, people who are experts in compost will say, you know, you can get really obsessive about it and trying to get the perfect compost, but really, it's all good, right?
Yeah.
So, and then the first one, daffodils and tulips, if they're perennial, daffodils and tulips are two different stories, aren't they, Peter?
Yeah, I've seen daffodils will last for a long time, so definitely daffodils are perennial. And you will see beds of those or those growing in fields where they'll be there for decades. Tulips are quite a bit different. Some people plant them almost as annuals, but depending on the vigor of the bulbs and whether or not you allow the plant to, after the flowers go by, allow the leaves to capture energy to strengthen the bulb. They can last a few years, but tulips will generally run down in a shorter order. Now, I have heard there are some companies now that are marketing a more perennial tulip that will last longer. But in general, daffodils are good long-term. Tulips are shorter-term.
All right, Steve, thanks for your question. We'll go to Chris, who's calling from Portland. Hi, Chris. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for including me in the conversation. My wife and I bought a house in the middle of the summer, and at the house, the previous owners had a beautiful raised bed garden with, I think there's 10 beds in there. Her and I have zero experience gardening and are a bit intimidated. The beds just went to weed all summer, so we eventually pulled weeds and just put plastic down to prevent the weeds. But we really have no idea where to start. So my question is, I'm wondering if you could help direct me to some information through the of information that's available. Are there any books or online sources that you find to be great for beginning gardeners?
Sure, Chris. Thanks so much for your call. I want to ask you say about 10 raised beds. Were these vegetable gardens or a variety of vegetables and flowers?
Great question.
Or do you know?
I'm not exactly sure what was in there before. One of them has lovage that grew up.
Lovage.
And then one of them has lovage. Okay.
That's a perennial herb.
Gotcha. Yeah, and it grew to be a massive plant. And the other one has high bush blueberries.
Oh, great.
And then there's some herbs and others.
Okay, great. Well, it's exciting, Chris, and I'm so glad you called because I know this happens with so many people that they buy that first house and it's got a yard and it has had a gardener. And if you don't have any experience, it can be overwhelming. I'm going to guess, Heather, that the UMaine Cooperative Extension might be a good place to start. Any other thoughts?
Well, since he's got a mixture of what are vegetable beds and herb beds and perennials, I'm a book person myself. And Barbara Damrosch's book, The Garden Primer, is, you know, she wrote it quite a few decades ago, but it really is an encyclopedic book on you know, all aspects of organic gardening and would cover all those different kind of plants, not just vegetables, not just herbs, not just flowers. So that's where I would turn, actually.
Okay, great. Peter, you have thoughts?
Yeah, I sympathize because a lot of people starting with gardens get very daunted by weeds and growth like that. But I think the primary thing is to have fun with it and to enjoy it. And I would look to local garden centers and plant purveyors, especially those that is their main business, that it's not a side issue, that if they are a nursery or a garden center. There's a lot of knowledge there. There's a lot of free advice there. Of course, they're selling a product as well, but there's a lot of you can have a lot of back and forth that you can't get from a book sometimes. So I think that's a good place to start. The other thing I might mention for beds where they get so weedy and get out of control, sometimes if you're maintaining your lawn without any chemical treatments, using lawn clippings after, like, let's say you planted a bed with tomato seedlings, and the soil warms up, then you could cover the soil with some lawn clippings as a way to keep the sun off and to keep the weed population down.
Using it as mulch.
Using it as a mulch, yeah.
Yeah. Chris, good luck. Have fun with your gardens. Kelly on Facebook writes, tips to help winter over rosemary and lavender.
Well, rosemary is not hardy here, so you're really going to have to bring, if it's in the ground, dig it up and put it in a big pot and bring it in somewhere where it's just above freezing. It likes a cool winter. It's a Mediterranean plant, so what it wants is, you know, Italy in the winter, which is raw but not frozen. So sometimes an unheated garage will work, or a basement, or if you have a greenhouse, it has to be cool, not 70 degrees, but more in the 50s.
How much sun? You say a garage. Does the garage need to have a window?
It's helpful. You know, you can wait really till we get a big frost before you have to do this. So, you know, well into November. And so if it's in there for 4 months, you know, by the early spring, it needs some light. Lavender is hardy here. Sometimes it dies over the winter, especially if it's a wet or icy winter, but that's hardy. So assuming you've planted it in the right place, and it also likes, it's from the Mediterranean also, and likes sandy or gravelly, well-drained soil. So when it's wet, that's when it doesn't do well in the winter. But if it's in a dry spot, it should do well.
And I want to build on Kelly's question. What other herbs may overwinter well? Will, for example, oregano overwinter?
Oregano will. Mm-hmm. Sage usually will. Chives will.
Okay.
I've grown a bay plant for many, many years. It's, you can't leave it outside, but as a pot, it works well to bring that in for the winter.
A bay as in bay leaves.
Bay leaves, correct.
Oh, wonderful.
And we have a native plant that you can use like bay leaf, which is bayberry, the native shrub. And you can use it just the way you use the bay leaf.
Kelly, thanks for your question. We'll go to David calling from Westbrook. Hi, David. Go ahead.
Hi. I have a question about native species. I've done a lot of reading and talked to some professional gardeners, and they talk about the connection between birds and food and native species, where they're native species, insects can feed, and they attract insects, and birds basically come down and they can survive. But if you have foreign species like the Norway maple, if they come down and a bunch of Norway maples, it's like a desert. And the birds basically have a very hard time with the proliferation of these native species, of these non-native species, in terms of even surviving.
Thanks for your call, David. And that's what you're talking about at the beginning, right,
Heather? Yes, that's why we need an abundance of native species in all of our landscapes, even our urban and suburban areas, that they're the ones that become part of the food webs. There's an excellent scientist, entomologist from University of Delaware named Doug Tallamy, and he's written a great book called Bringing Nature Home. And his research has really, shined a light on how it's the native species of plants that support the insects, particularly butterflies and moths in their caterpillar stage, have to live on a native species. So people are familiar with how the monarch butterfly needs milkweed. Well, that's not a rare relationship in nature. You know, all the different butterflies and moths need native tree, shrub, or wildflower species for part of their life cycle. And so that's why it matters. And the new science shows we really need to have 70% of a landscape has to have the 70% biomass of indigenous plants to support those food webs. So one of the reasons our bird populations have plummeted is there's not the food for them. And it's the butterfly and moth caterpillars that are number one bird food, especially for rearing their young.
When you say 70% of the landscape, as a home gardener, do I want to aim for 70%?
That's brand new research that he's just figured out. Yes.
So where is Maine now, taken sort of as a whole?
Well, Maine
populated
has a lot.
Maine, I'm not talking about.
Yeah. So in the more natural areas, forest, that's still predominantly native. Meadows and farmland, you know, the meadows, 50% of the species are typically not native. A lot of the grasses are Eurasian. Mm-hmm. And then in urban and suburban areas, you know, it can really vary. It can be very small percentage where people have a lot of lawn and a Norway maple and a Kalahari pear and a couple Asian hydrangeas, then there's really nothing for those insects to eat, and those insects are the primary food of birds. It means biomass. So let's say you like some of these exotic plants that aren't invasive. Just aim for planting some native trees and you'll get a lot of biomass. Doesn't mean you have to remove all exotic species.
I think there was kind of two parts to David's question. One, I think Heather's really addressed well, is in springtime when birds are raising their young, they need the caterpillars. But I think also I picked up in his question something about later in the season when their birds are perhaps migrating and looking to feed. The native fruits from native plants are better suited for in the their nutritional composition. It's a little bit like eating candy bars as opposed to eating a good meal. So there is that aspect as well. I think his question kind of spanned the season.
Yeah, David, thanks so much for calling. We'll go to Ariel, who's calling from Saco. Hi, Ariel, go ahead.
Hi, I kind of have an opposite question to one of the previous callers. I also bought my first home this summer, and the previous owners of our home had turned everything into a lawn. So we have half an acre that's all grass. And we didn't have the time this summer, but next spring we want to turn most of the lawn into space to grow food. So I was wondering, what is the best steps we can take this fall to prepare the land to grow crops in the spring?
Are you talking for yourself, just your home vegetable garden?
Yes. So
well,
I was wondering if there's things we should do now or in the fall to get the ground ready, since it's all grass, or we should just wait for the spring?
No, dig up the grass now. You could cover crop it or add the compost now. The fall is a great time to prepare the site. Then you'll be ready to plant in the spring and instead of having to do all the work in the spring.
Okay, I'm going to stop you right there. You said dig up the grass now.
Sorry.
For a half acre. Yes. How does one dig up the grass
now? You don't want a half acre vegetable garden, at least not to start.
How do you suggest she dig up the grass?
Well, I'm really in favor of the smothering method where you put down newspaper or cardboard with mulch on top. I mean, she could have someone come in and rototill it initially. You don't want to rototill every year, or from then in the future, but you could rototill it and sow a cover crop. That would be very low maintenance.
Okay.
And I'm sure Peter has some good
ideas.
If it was me, I would have dug it all by hand. I would pick a few areas to dig out by hand and get ready right away, and I'd pick some other areas to smother. Because if you're not going to want to plant the whole thing next year. So you could be preparing it in stages and not biting off more than you can chew.
Yeah, when I was younger, I think I would take the shovel myself and just go back and forth. But I think it's good to sort of make a layout for what you want. I think one of the advantages of when people do raised beds is they pick an area that they're not going to walk in, and their aisles can remain lawn or some other material. But if you turn the whole area over, that's quite a project. And for that kind of size, I think a rototiller probably is in order.
All right. Well, Ariel, thanks so much for calling. Congratulations on your first home. We are going to take another quick break. More of your questions when we come back. We're talking about gardening on Maine Calling.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Friends of Acadia, members and volunteers preserving the splendor of Acadia National Park for current and future generations. Friendsofacadia.org. And AARP Maine, working to lower prescription drug costs. Learn more at aarp.org/rx.
Coming up on the next Commonwealth Club program, since 2009, the ride-hailing service called Uber has proved to be a major disruptor to transportation plans and companies in cities around the world. Journalist Mike Isaac explains that the company's internal culture made it into one of the major examples of Silicon Valley misbehavior. The next Commonwealth Club radio program.
That's coming up this afternoon at 2 here on Maine Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, as the formal impeachment inquiry poses the greatest threat yet to the Trump presidency, we look at the life and career of Vice President Pence. Veteran political reporter Tom LoBianco has covered Pence for decades. He's just written a new book called Piety and Power, Mike Pence and the Taking of the White House. Join us.
You can hear Fresh Air this evening at 7 here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, we're talking about gardening, and we're talking about native plants, too. Joining me, Heather McCargo with the Wild Seed Project and Peter Bacher with Maine Audubon. Join our conversation at 1-800-399-3566. Before we go back to the calls, let's talk about leaves. All over Maine, pretty soon people are going to go to the hardware store and buy bags and fill them up and take them to the dump. But you probably, I'm guessing, Heather, as you're grinning ear to ear, do not advocate that approach.
No. So, you know, during the growing season, those trees have photosynthesized with those leaves. That's how trees make their food. You know, they, you know, plants are different than animals. They make their food from sunlight, water, and carbon dioxide. And it's been, some of it's gone into their leaves, and then in the fall, the deciduous trees drop their leaves, and that's how nutrients are recycled in nature. Now, lawns are, you know, that's a highly bred plant that's been selected to handle our foot traffic. No other plant can handle that, and they don't like to be smothered under leaves. So when your leaves fall down, you can rake them off your lawn, you can rake them off your sidewalk and driveway, but put them on the rest of your beds because that will return the nutrients to the soil. It will also protect the earth from the freeze and thaw. It also happens to be where a lot of butterflies and moths and other creatures overwinter in that leaf litter. So if you like swallowtail butterflies, they need to spend the winter under the leaf litter.
So how thick? If you're raking up your leaves and you're putting them in your perennial beds or your vegetable garden, I mean, is there a limit to how dense you want those leaves? And also, what about oak leaves? Aren't they a little bit different because of the sort of coating on the leaves?
They're not different. They just take longer to break down. So if you feel like you have, let's say you have a lot of sidewalk or patio or driveway that you're raking off, you could put some of those extra leaves in a compost bin instead of directly in your garden, you know. But they can handle a lot of leaf litter. If you want to get a sense of it, go into the forest in October as the leaves fall and see how much comes down. And that has, you know, last year leaves have already broken down.
All right. We have a whole bunch of questions from Mike about perennials and dividing and transplanting perennials. So I just wanted to talk just a little bit about that. How do you get a sense of when it might be time to divide a perennial? Maybe you planted it 5 years ago and it's gotten pretty big and unwieldy. Are there general rules of thumb and general rules of thumb about spacing perennials, Peter?
Well, there's a lot of variation in that. There's some plants that when you plant them, they do not like to be disturbed or divided, and others really respond to it. Some of the bearded iris and things like that really need to be divided or they start to decline. So it's hard to give a general answer because it will vary by species. And some are a lot more forgiving. You can do almost anything to a daylily and it will survive.
Sure, Siberian iris too, right?
Yeah, that too.
I know somebody who used to mow his Siberian iris. But so it depends on the species. For most and many perennials, the more common ones that folks might have in their garden, is now a good time to be dividing them?
It's fine. The soil's warm. It would be a fine time to divide. For many, fall is a time also to for peonies, for lifting, if you're going to lift peonies and divide them. I generally do that in the spring.
But there's no...
I don't think there's a hard and fast rule. Time? Are you aware of a hard?
Well, I would only divide a perennial if it looked like it was not thriving anymore. Otherwise, leave it alone. And yes, like the bearded irises, they start to crowd each other out. But September is a good time. Yeah. You know, the falls are warmer and warmer. So 20 years ago, you would say not after the end of September. You can also do it early spring. So that's the second the ground thaws, not once the plant is up. You know, that's the mistake people make. They wait till the plant's really in active growth or maybe even flowering and then try to dig up and move it. Well, that's a terrible time. You know, couldn't be more stressful. So, you know, you don't need to divide all of your perennials. And yes, they would need a reference book because it's different for each species.
We've had two calls from beginner gardeners, and would you all advise to, it's so tempting when you're starting a garden to plant everything really close together and make it look really great that first year. What kind of advice do you give about sort of keeping yourself from doing that and giving the perennials some space?
Well, I think perennials are very forgiving in that they're so easy to move. When you plant woody plants, it's much more of a project. If you say, you know, if you put things too close together, all of a sudden you're going to try and move an 8-foot plant. That's a problem. But perennials can be a lot more forgiving in that way. So
go ahead, plant them close together and move them in a few
years. Yeah, we want
cover the ground.
We want to cover every square inch of ground with plants. You know, people have come to think that plants are supposed to be islands with a sea of mulch around them. You know, no, we need vegetation everywhere. Then you won't have weeds and you'll have more photosynthesis going on, more carbon sequestered. So, you know, it costs more money to do them close together, but it's not going to hurt the plants unless they're, like Peter said, woody plants. You want to think about the spacing a little more because they're a lot more work and they don't like to be moved.
Okay. Patrick's calling from Woolwich. Patrick, I think you're going to have a question that a lot of people have. Go for it.
Oh, thanks. I've been doing some clearing on my property recently and came across a bunch of bittersweet, and now I've pulled it all out. I'm curious how I can properly dispose of it so it doesn't repropagate. Can I put it through the chipper? Should I burn it? What's the best way to get rid of that for good?
Well, Peter's been dealing with it on Audubon properties. What do you guys do? Do you put it in a burn? Do you burn it?
I haven't burned it. In smaller increments, I would dispose of it, throw it away. I do have an area where I'm composting stuff, and it's a small enough area that I will throw sometimes that material in there, even though I know there can be seeds because it's a localized area that I'm managing. But I think burning in a small setting like that, I think burning it would be fine. Just have a little barbecue and burn it.
Mm. Okay, Peter. Patrick, good luck to you. We're going to go to Brendan calling from Bangor. Hi, Brendan. Go ahead.
Oh, hi. So thanks so much for taking my call. Sorry, I was on speaker for a second. So I just wanted to say I'm calling right now from my back garden, which actually is planted with seeds from the Wild Seed Project and also from a Rebel Hill Nursery, which is a really great Maine native nursery. And, you know, it's such a joy to come out here every morning and look at all the bees and the butterflies and the beetles. And I'm also restoring a non-native dominated field to native meadow. And I just wanted to give a little shout out to doing rotational mowing, right? So just mowing a little portion of your field every year so that the wildlife can benefit much more than if it's all just cut down to the ground. And along the field, there's also a lot of old apple trees. And, you know, they're not originally native, of course, but they've become naturalized. And it really seems that, you know, they, unlike most non-natives, they really are very beneficial. And so my question is, you know, are there other non-natives that, you know, like our apple trees, are okay?
That's a good question.
I do recall from the professor that Heather mentioned, Doug Talamay, speaking that way about willows as well. I heard him, the non-native willows, the insects don't seem to know the difference. They, as with apples, apples not being native, but we still get the insects on apples.
People sometimes get confused and they'll say, okay, you know, the bees are still coming to my plant. The, you know, a lot of our pollinators can drink nectar from the non-native plants. And yes, in the case of apple, that apple trees don't cause any problem, but it still doesn't host the whole life cycle. That's really the issue. But are there other, you know, the problem with willows that I'm aware of is the Asian and European willows hybridize. Willows hybridize really easily. So an introduced willow will, you know, we will lose our indigenous willow species through hybridization with exotics. So it's a complicated question that we don't all know the answer to. So what we do know is the real problem plant. So let's start by staying away from them and adding more native species. You know, that's heading us in the right direction.
And the real problem plants being?
Well, there's a whole list that this, you know, is published now by the state of invasive species that are illegal to sell. So you can get that on the Maine government website or the Maine Natural Areas Program.
Brendan, thanks for your call. Xanada on Facebook says, potatoes. I planted some seed potatoes in a 5-gallon bucket that has drainage holes in it and loaded some dirt on top of them. They have sprouted even more with greenery. So I followed a rumor and loaded more dirt on top of that, and the greenery is popping through. How do I know when to harvest potatoes? They are all in that bucket outside in dirt laced with local farm-sourced compost. What to do? What to do? This is such a fun question. Potatoes are really fun to grow if you're a beginning gardener, and they're also, they can get out of control and feel like, you're laughing, Peter.
Well, there's so many ways that I've seen people grow potatoes. Well, you can plant them in an old tire, and then as the plant grows up, you add more soil and add another tire, and then keep going and going. And eventually you take the whole thing apart, and there's supposed to be potatoes all the way down. But it is true, you want to keep pushing the green up, but typically this time of year it starts to die back. The species of potato that she's growing would probably indicate whether it's an early, mid. I suspect it's a late season potato. So I suspect she's getting close to the time to
harvest.
So
generally speaking, when the greenery grows back is the time to harvest potatoes. But isn't it true that really no time is a bad time?
Yes.
They're just smaller.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right.
New potato, you know, they're considered more delicious when you harvest your potatoes early in the summer. They're small, but they're less starchy. And those are called new potatoes.
Yeah, and it sounds like she tried really hard to get great soil. And one of the beauties of potatoes, isn't it, that there's a reason people in places like Ireland and Sweden grew them. It's hard to go wrong.
Yeah,
it's a lot of fun. So we'll go to Peter calling from Skowhegan. Hi, Peter. Go ahead.
Hi, thank you. Earlier you were talking about black-eyed Susans. And I was wondering, here in the state of Maine, do we have two distinct species of black-eyed Susans? Because I notice when I go walking through the meadows, I'll see one plant that has very long, pointed petals, and then another plant will have short, blunt end petals. So I don't know if that's just a, you know, a natural mutation or if it's actually a distinct disease.
Okay. Do you know the answer, Heather?
Well, where did you say you were? Skowhegan? So I've never seen the true subspecies that's native to Maine in the wild, but you should go look on the Go Botany website run by the Native Plant Trust, and you can search for Maine, and it will show pictures of the different subspecies. So I can't tell from your question if that's just natural variation, you know, because there is variation among individuals. So it could just be due to that and different populations, or maybe you really are looking at something different. I don't know.
There's also the USDA maintains a native plant database, which often has good photos and will show the native range of all the different Rudbeckia, so you could explore it in that way too.
All right, Peter, thanks for your question. We'll go to Glenn calling from Brunswick. Hi, Glenn. We're getting to the end of the show, so if you could be quick, that'd be great.
Okay, great. I have really begun to enjoy butterflies, and I have been very successful in starting to see them multiply year after year. How do I grow milkweed, and do plants like winterberry, can you pull berries off and throw them like into the woods? Will they grow automatically? That's all I have. I'm just trying to get more native things going.
Well, I hope you'll go visit the Wild Seed Project's website because we're full of information on that. Milkweed's very easy to grow from seed. I recommend people plant it outdoors in pots in the late fall, and it will germinate in the spring. Winterberry holly is, you know, those berries are designed to go through the stomach of a bird, and so you need to squeeze the seeds out. They have these seeds that can't dry out. They need to be sown right away, and they will take 2 winters before they'll germinate. So you can do it. So just throwing the berries in the woods, you know, it's hard to tell whether that will work or not.
All right, Glenn, thanks for your call. I'm going to try to squeeze one more in there. David in Gorham. Hi, David, go ahead.
Hi, this is David. My question was actually very similar to the previous question, so I'm going to change it up a little bit. I was looking at planting a butterfly and herb garden, and you answered a lot of the questions about the butterfly portion, but about herbs, what would be a good starting point for herbs? What, you know, easy to grow, when should I plant? And I'll take my answers offline. Thank you.
I would generally start with an herb garden with what you want to use, because I think you're aiming for something different there. So the basics, you know, sage, thyme, parsley, rosemary, bay. I think I would work backwards from what you, what herbs you'd like
what
to have.
What you like to cook with.
Right.
Yeah. Thoughts, Heather?
And yeah, I would plant, those species are all Mediterranean, so I wouldn't plant them now. I'd wait till the spring.
Right.
The other easy ones are chives and parsley to add in with them. But then things like basil, that really does better in your vegetable garden because it's a real high moisture and nutrient needing plant.
Yeah.
One of the beauties of those other herbs is they're very resilient and easy to grow without fertile soil.
Well, this was so much fun. Thank you both for being here. The voice you just heard, Heather McCargo, founder and executive director of the Wild Seed Project. Also here, Peter Bacher, director of operations with Maine Audubon. Lucy Suchek ran the board today. We had additional help from Rich Tozier. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Just to note that Maine Calling will not be rebroadcast tonight at 8. Instead, Maine Public will carry an hour-long special on today's congressional hearing with the Director of National Intelligence. You can always go to mainepublic.org or mainecalling.org to hear past Maine Calling shows. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.